Welcome to The Reason Podcast. I'm Jim Epstein. Today's show is all about the technological hurdles facing the decentralized computing platform, Ethereum. If Bitcoin is primarily a peer-to-peer currency, Ethereum is a peer-to-peer global computing network that promises to remake the internet and disintermediate every aspect of our online lives. And like with Bitcoin, it would be nearly impossible for governments to control what happens on Ethereum. As co-founder Joe Lubin put it in an interview with Reason last year, Ethereum is an unstoppable computational machine. And though Bitcoin has had a tremendous year so far, Ethereum has done even better, with investment in the network growing about 3,000% this year to roughly $20 billion. But Ethereum also faces enormous technical problems, and it's not at all clear that it's capable of ever scaling to serve millions of users. To discuss, my guest today is Michael Friedman. In addition to being a Princeton computer science professor with a specialty in distributed systems, Friedman worked on an earlier wave of peer-to-peer technologies, starting in the late 90s. He's now the co-founder of the database company Timescale, and also serves as an advisor to a computing project that has similar goals to Ethereum called Blockstack, which was also the subject of a recent Reason TV video that I'll link to in the show notes. I started by asking Friedman to explain his reservations about Ethereum.
The problem, I think, is that the timeline for these things are very uncertain. And this is along the time where we've seen this rapid increase in adoption of Ethereum, and, you know, now hundreds of millions or billions of dollars being put into this. And so the question is, are we going to be able to develop the technology at the same speed at which we're jumping in terms of demand? And the problem, you know, why this is a real problem, I think fundamentally, is that many of the main technique that allowed us to achieve the security we have in Bitcoin or in Ethereum, that is that effectively everybody can validate every transaction on the network, everything that happens on the network, is also what inhibits its scale. The fact that there's no secret information, or the fact that there's basically one kind of global historical log, means that we kind of can't split this up into little things going off to the side, which is normally how we kind of scale these things. Everybody does a little work off to the side, and then all together we make forward progress.
So
that's
this
fundamentally
is
hard in this kind of new model of global consensus.
This is the blockchain that you're referring to, this idea that everyone can see every bit of information.
Correct. Everybody can see every bit of information, or that there's really, even putting aside the global visibility, there's really just one historical log of basically every event that happens in the whole world.
And why is it hard to scale a system like that?
Well, because it kind of requires that as somebody is trying to make some progress, you basically keep in your head everything else that happened in the world. Now imagine that, you know, if you're trying to learn something where, you know, in your mind you have to think about all other, you know, worldly information that's happening at that same time. Effectively, that's the current, you know, that's currently how blockchain works. Everybody knows everything in the world. While on the flip side, you know, the traditional way we've known to scale for now decades is you kind of split up the work. You only focused on your little bit of the information you care about. Other people could focus on theirs. You know, ne'er the twain shall meet, in that you don't care about their work and therefore you don't need to kind of track it.
Okay. So, and we have Bitcoin is sort of a cryptocurrency. It's a currency system where you see all transaction in the ledger. Ethereum takes us to another level because it's attempting to be a global computer where all computation happens in this ledger, or essential computation in this sort of shared database that everybody sees. And that's kind of what needs to be this element where everyone sees all of these computations. That's what you're not sure about. Is it that it becomes too much data? And the ledger, this kind of shared database, becomes too long or too large in terms of gigabytes? Or is it something else? Is it about the way the information flows?
It's kind of, these two things are very much related because, you know, as you currently have this global ledger, the more that you're trying to do at any one time, like, you know, if we're trying to do 100 things at once versus 100,000 things at once, you know, effectively the ledger is going to grow at a different rate. So the fact that as more people try to use it, you know, we go from trying to do, you know, one or two transactions a second to seven transactions a second to 100 to, you know, a million transactions a second. And those are orders of magnitude changes, which mean that, one, everybody participating has to download more data just to keep up. And two, you know, the growth of this ledger continues to get larger and larger over time. And so it's really almost the fact that at any one time, the fact that you need to do so much more just to keep up, kind of that's the scalability problem. You know, the way if you look at the shift of computing, there was a big change in the 90s, which is when we went from these, what they sometimes refer to as scale up, where you have mainframes, or you kind of build bigger and bigger individual computers, versus scale out, where you have, you know, normal, you know, the things that Google's running and the thing that you have running on your laptop are kind of very similar. And in fact, it's just that, you know, Google or Facebook will run a million of them or 10 million of these computers at once, as opposed to the one on your desktop. So it's not that they've built a giant computer. They just have a lot of computers that do things in parallel. And that's kind of the scaling problem we're here. So far, the way that we have scaled blockchain technologies and in all the current proposals about making the block size bigger and doing some other things are all still about scaling up. How do you build effectively bigger and faster mainframes? When if we really want to scale, when we want to hit those next, you know, orders of magnitude we need to do, then we need to go into the scaling out. How do we do things a lot in parallel? And that's something that the technologies just don't yet have.
Okay. Well, the big idea that you hear in the Ethereum space is called sharding. And this is, in a nutshell, and you can correct me, this idea is that this is how the Ethereum network is going to scale. And it's that not every computer, every node in the system needs to be updated with all of the current information, but rather individual nodes, kind of what you're saying, spread out, can kind of do it locally, and then maybe at some later point they'll all come into consensus, and that this will sort of solve the bottlenecking problem or the what do you think about this idea of sharding?
I mean, this is certainly everything I've talked about so far about scaling out in some sense uses what some might term sharding. So this is not at all a new technology. You know, this is how systems have been scaling out since the 90s. The real question is, you know, what are the technical challenges between trying to do this scaling out and yet still provide the type of strong security guarantees one wants in these blockchains? So, you know, it is not at all surprising that, you know, one turns to sharding here. It's the general technique that we've been using for a long time now. You know, the question was how you you know, satisfy those needs with also the fact that it's harder to make work in this world where you want these kind of global consensus problems. And you know, probably compared to a lot of other computer systems now, the security risks are so much greater, because, you know, now the penalty for getting it wrong, you know, could be hundreds of millions of dollars. You know, when that's not normally the cost of an individual bug, however minor, in, you know, a normal type of internet infrastructure.
Could sharding work?
These are kind of formal mathematical things. Until you have any impossibility results, which I know of no one here, you know, it's very unwise to think that nothing could ever happen. You know, if you just say, taking the lay answers, it's difficult but possible. You know, we'll see how long this will take. We'll see how this will be aligned with what is also desired. And the reason I say that is because, you know, right now, most blockchain technologies give a, and I kind of don't want to go into all the technical details, but they give this kind of strong notion of consensus, although a slightly weird one, because you might not reach that. You might not be guaranteed that consensus until, you know, an hour later after enough work has happened in the blockchain.
What do you mean when you say, define that in terms of consensus? They give you a sense of consensus. What does that
right.
mean?
Right. So there's notions of there's consistency notions in distributed systems. And so this is effectively like, you know, when you go into the bank and you see that you have a certain amount of money in the bank, you don't expect it all of a sudden to change randomly. On the flip side, if you've ever tried to add something to your Amazon shopping cart, you might have noticed that there might be some periods of time where you might see something in your shopping cart twice before it resolves itself. This is not really a bug. This is the fact that Amazon has decided to design their systems in a certain way to basically stress availability. That is, they always want their service to be online and allow you to add stuff to your shopping cart over the fact of always basically being strongly consistent. And this strongly consistent is in the blockchain what they sometimes refer to as consensus. Consensus is that we have many parties which are reaching agreement, and what they're reaching agreement on is the state of the world. So in particular, they're reaching agreement on who owns this coin. You don't want two people to own the coin at one time. Now, the way this works in the blockchain is that people could cheat for short periods of time, or that there's actually a lot of divergence for the very recent time. But what happens is over time, in particular, after several of these blocks get released and turned into a chain, it basically will take more and more work, that is basically burning computational cycles and money effectively to try to rewrite history. So what people basically do is say, well, if this is been around for a while, you know, this has been around for, you know, often it's common to be for an hour or so, then, you know, I'm kind of good enough with the risk of how much effort it would take somebody else to try to rewrite history. And so this basically said that after you have that historical record, after a certain amount of time, basically the entire world agreed on exactly one record of history. And there are alternate consistency models, for example, which are that, you know, if you and I are, let's say, running computer programs, you and I are selling goods, selling coins, and, you know, I buy a coffee from the local bodega in New York, and you're in London, you know, and buy something at the nearest pub, you know, why does the world need to know that, you know, you bought your beer before I bought my coffee, right? That yours happened before mine. They really have nothing to do with one another.
And that's because you have like a credit card process. You have a third party kind of running that financial transaction, which is what you don't have in the blockchain world. Is that right?
Well, yes, but I'm actually kind of asking the question more from kind of a fundamental thing, which is in a blockchain which has one global log of all historical records, the blockchain will actually have a record of saying is that you bought your beer 3 hours before I bought my coffee. And the kind of different question is why, given that, you know, you're halfway around the world and your coin that you used to buy your beer has anything to do with the money I used to buy my coffee, why do we need to establish this strict ordering between them, right? And so one of the ways that there's alternate models in distributed systems that allows us to, let's say, not decide which one comes first, because effectively it says, well, they don't have any relationship to another, so why do we need to actually ever make that decision? And so this allows us to what we might call as weaken the consistency model. And that allows us to have more flexibility and cheaper protocols. So one of the ways we might see it is that a way that some of these systems might scale to greater sharding is they could actually change their model about what the system provides. And so, again, kind of the possibility of this depends ultimately on what our final model is and what we want from it. And because everything right now is a little bit up in the air and not kind of well defined or formally considered, kind of hard to tell what is actually going on and what the properties it finally will have.
To kind of continue with your analogy, though, in the blockchain world, and whether it be Bitcoin or Ethereum, the order of while in the world where you're buying coffee or beer, the timing doesn't matter. In the blockchain world, the timing is essential.
In the blockchain world, it captures, it expresses that timing. And so my point is, then you could say, well, we have difficulty in achieving the scale out in a world that captures that timing. You might ask the question, well, is that timing actually fundamental? And if it's not fundamental, can we weaken our need to capture that timing and therefore allow us to build, you know, blockchain-based stuff that could scale better based on certain types of interactions because we don't need to ever capture their timing with respect to one another?
But what you're weakening is the sort of the essence of what the blockchain brings to the table.
There are certain. I'm pausing in my answer because that is weakening the current a current essence of the blockchain. I totally agree with that. I think the question that people have always asked in these type of distributed systems are there are always trade-offs. In fact, in this area that I start talking about it, there are kind of known results. There are known impossibility results about how much you could scale or you know how available can we make these systems that have such strong consistency properties like the blockchain currently has. And so what I'm saying is this might open up the door in kind of creating a more expansive view about how do we how do we develop different types of blockchains or add different properties if we're trying to optimize for different things. You know, right now we optimized for effectively strong global agreement. This is kind of global consistency of all operations. And it might be that we gave up certain things of scale to do so. And maybe there's other systems where we could achieve slightly different properties in terms of security and consistency for much better abilities to scale.
Okay, so what in terms of that analogy, though, this idea that's called sharding, which is sort of the big idea in the Ethereum community for how we're going to scale this system. How does that work, and how does it weaken this kind of system of consensus?
Yeah, unfortunately, I did spend some time. You know, I'm not necessarily always catching up to the, you know, what came out in Ethereum this week. But I did spend some time trying to, understand at the more technical level all the details with sharding, and to be fair, right now it seems a little less defined to me. So it's kind of hard for me to answer that given that. It didn't seem sufficiently well specified or formally specified for me to kind of be able to make a deep technical understanding.
Well, sharding is this old technique. You wrote a paper about sharding in 2003. Sharding is a technique that's constantly used in kind of making the internet run. What is sharding? Let's start there.
Sure. So sharding is basically saying that if you have a big data set or database, usually split it into lots of parts and let those parts operate independently. So if you think about your disk on your computer, you have one, let's say you store 1 terabyte of data on your disk. You can't buy currently easily a 10 terabyte disk. So let's run 10 disks instead. And they each have, you know, 1/10 of the amount of data. That basically is what sharding says.
And then why is it difficult to apply this concept to the Ethereum space?
Well, Ethereum and Bitcoin and all these blockchain technologies are similar in that each computer, in this example, each disk is supposed to see all the data to make sure that you didn't, let's say, do something different. So you didn't take the same coin, and let's say, again, if I go back in there, my analogy before of 10 disks, let's say there's there's 10 separate computers, separate people. I didn't try to spend the same coin with, you know, person three as person seven, or I didn't try to execute a program differently at program three and program seven and kind of cause the world state to diverge. In Bitcoin, I take that coin, I spend it, and all 10 nodes sees that I spent it in one way. If in a world where they only see a small portion of the data, a node responsible for that small portion might not see that I took this coin and I spent it with some other party, because they're not storing that party's data.
So the trick then with sharding would be to allow a certain amount of the information slip through, so everyone can see something, but maybe not all of it. And that way you can kind of, everyone can be up to date with the essential information. Is that, I guess that's, I assume what they're talking about when they talk about applying sharding to Ethereum. Is that right?
Well, yeah. And this is, and like I said, this is when I think some of the low level details matter a lot, in that effectively what you're going to need to do is to make sure that kind of the fact that, let's, in my example, I tried to kind of split what was one party into 10, right? I still need to make sure that everybody sees kind of the right, just enough data in such a way that I can't slip through a transaction. And it might turn out that the way you design it, it could, let's say, scale, you know, in the example analogy I had of this thing in New York and this beer in London, I was able to say, well, this didn't matter because they didn't have anything to do with one another. And so, you know, what happens, in fact, if that, you know, bartender in London immediately took the coin you went to spend it on and tried to spend it in New York City? It might turn out that in that case, they do matter. They are related. So the fact of your ability to scale might also, in fact, be a function of the workload of the system. How closely related, how intertwined are all of these operations to one another, and what does that mean in terms of my need to kind of keep all the different parties up to date with how each other is behaving? And so there's a bunch of these different unknowns based on how well does the system allow me to update minimal information, and how much does my workload even impact my ability to scale these things. And these are all details that need to be kind of explored and worked out.
Well, so they need to be worked out, but the idea is that you're saying they can be worked out. I mean, give me a sense of sort of what, how big a problem is this in terms of figuring out the technical details to make this pretty exciting technology called Ethereum grow so that it can serve millions of people.
You know, I don't like being a trying to predict the rate of technical change. These are probably easier than putting somebody on Mars. You know, harder than building your latest website. The problem is, you know, there's there's a lot of unknowns here, and you know it's always really difficult to predict the speed of
does how it require some sort of a technical breakthrough? Is it uncharted territory technically? Do they have to figure something out that people that have been thinking, working in the field of distributed systems, have not figured out up to this point?
I think there are definitely aspects of this that require some technical breakthroughs. A lot of the technical challenges, and the reason computer science is somewhat different than a lot of fields, which is that sometimes create the world in which we operate. So if you're, you know, building a rocket ship, there are fundamentals of gravity that you need to deal with. If you're doing chemistry, there's fundamentals of the world that you need to deal with. In computer science, what's interesting is that we could kind of tweak our worldview in order to make systems easier to build. So in the example I gave before, I said, well, it might be particularly difficult if we want this global consensus to scale. And in fact, this has been, you know, an outstanding problem probably the weaker form of this has been an outstanding problem for at least 25 years. The first person to basically develop what we now think of as general consensus protocols actually won the Turing Award, which is computer science early highest prize, kind of like our Nobel Prize. Leslie Lamport, who developed some of these early consensus algorithms in the first place, but they have always required basically everybody participate in the interactions. Now, the question is, how can we change that? You know, do we think that we're not going to change any of our assumptions and just make progress while adding on to that the additional complexity of all the security aspects of blockchain? Maybe. But it's difficult because, you know, when people have been working on this for so long, the question is, you know, what do we know now? What has changed that people haven't changed before? One of the common ways you kind of do this is you kind of change your model. You say, well, I'm not going to work on the same problem. I'm going to work on a slightly easier problem and being able to make progress on that. So, you know, from what I do understand, it sounds like the Ethereum community is probably making the smart approach of actually trying to solve an easier problem. And so the uncertainty really is how easy are they ultimately going to make this? And what do they give up in order to achieve those new properties, new scaling properties?
What they don't want to give up, though, is the whole, the purpose of the system is decentralization. It's that we can run online applications, we can engage in forms of trade that don't require a third party, whether it be the government or a bank, et cetera. And I guess the question is, it sounds like what you're saying is, if you bring a third party into it, it's much easier to solve these problems in terms of scalability. You get something that looks a little bit more like what we have in today's internet. The question is...
I wasn't only saying, I mean, a trusted party is one direction, but I wasn't saying that. I mean, Bitcoin, I mean, from 10,000 feet or layperson's perspective, you could say, you know, Bitcoin or blockchain was doing decentralization. You know, as you know from my own background, we were, you know, decentralization has always been in a kind of cyclical aspect of the internet. The whole start of the internet in the 1960s and 70s was the very notion that we didn't want a centralized telecommunication network. We wanted, it's called the internet because it's the network of many networks. We wanted to be able to, in a decentralized fashion, connect together a lot of networks and make them work. If you fast forward to the kind of late 90s and really starting with around 2000, we had this rise of interest in peer-to-peer systems. And that, again, was very much decentralized. In some sense, even more decentralized than blockchain was today, because there was no kind of well-defined miners that are now getting this kind of centralization effect of basically running big mining rigs. But they didn't have the same type of strong consistency properties that blockchain has. So again, we certainly know how to build decentralized systems that are scalable. But, you know, what blockchain was able to do was saying, how do we actually get some decentralization while also getting these strong security or consistency properties? So now the question is, what does the middle ground look like, and ultimately, how will that fall out?
Well, and a difference in blockchain, and this goes for Bitcoin and Ethereum, is that there's a lot of money at stake. There's money running in this system, and that's not true. It wasn't true of all these earlier decentralized systems, right?
And that's good and bad. The good thing is, you know, maybe it enables it not to just be the side project that you could hack on the weekend. You could spend real money hiring top people working on this thing. The bad side is it raised the bar, and it means that little bugs are really bad. You know, the Dow had, 25 or 30 million lost just last week or something. We had a $30 plus million heist of the software to store wallets, multi-sig wallets. And so it creates a really high bar to get things right because the incentives for trying to break these things are so strong.
People in this space have drawn these analogies between the challenges of scaling the early internet and these challenges of scaling networks like Ethereum. And you worked in these early internet scaling on these early internet scaling problems. Is there an analogy?
Well, I should say, that was, 30 or 40 years before my time, but
well, you started in 1999 you worked on CDN, right? Which addressed the slash dot effect, which was slash dot was a website that was a kind of aggregator that would send a ton of traffic to a site and kind of blow it off the network, and you were looking for solutions to that. So when you started these internet scaling issues, the internet had many fewer users, and it wasn't clear that it was going to be able to scale to billions. Maybe it was. I don't know.
So set the bar. A lot of the earlier work, and I'm talking about making the underlying internet, the communication. This was going on in the early 70s. By the time all these peer-to-peer systems were being looked at, this was after they were, the whole e-commerce growth, and we already had an internet which was at least hundreds of millions, if not billions of users. Now, I do think that the parallel, on one hand, the parallel isn't great. On one hand, these systems are all trying to figure out how to scale. But, what we were doing before was trying to just allow anybody to communicate with any other party. And now I think it's almost a return to the opposite. We went from a world where we're going to allow millions or billions of people just keep separate data to a world of the blockchain where we need to say there's a global ledger. In fact, we're re-centralizing all of the knowledge. Now, it's not by centralized. It's not that it's run by one party, but that all the knowledge is known by each party. And so that's almost counter to these other things where we try to split up the knowledge and allow everybody just to deal with their local information. And so now the question, what all this debate upon is how do we deal with these two properties which somewhat look at their fundamental face at odds? How do we split it so that we can kind of split the knowledge across all the world so we can scale to really high numbers? On the flip side, how do we do so in a way that kind of keeps enough people looking at what each party is working on? So like we can do things like what is sometimes known as equivocate, which is tell different parties different types of information. And that's kind of, this equivocation is fundamentally what attacking the blockchain is about, what double spending is with Bitcoin. What it's saying is I'm going to try to take one coin and spend it with two different parties. Equivocation is I'm going to take kind of one fact and give different answers to different people. And when we have split up all of our knowledge in different parts, then that's hard to do, or that's easy to do. When we've kind of brought all the knowledge together and says every party needs to know about all the knowledge in the world, that's kind of how the blockchain makes this problem go away.
Talking about the early internet again, and before your time, obviously, you've talked about how the genius of the internet was that it was built in layers, right? And that at its core is this very simple, these simple computer programs called protocols. Talk about that, and then also tell me about talk about Ethereum in that context. Does Ethereum violate that sort of that ingenious infrastructure or ingenious structure?
So if you remember why it's called the internet, a network of networks, what was happening is that everybody had there were all these different computer networks running around the world. And, there wasn't agreement. There were old telecom networks. There were IBM had their own standards of what these networks should be. Ethernet started coming about at the time. And what the internet was, it was originally a project out of the defense, or funded by the Defense Department. It was called the ARPANET, or the DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Project Administration. And it was attempting to basically define a protocol by which you could connect these disparate separate networks and allow computers across them to communicate. So it kind of was meant to be this a kind of global language by which you could actually have computers on different networks actually reach one another, connect them together. And that was what is now known as the Internet Protocol, or IP. And on top of that, people started asking the question is, should we need to, you know, what should the intermediate layers look like? You know, one of the fundamental ideas in computer science is also that of abstraction. And abstraction says that we could define interfaces so that they could kind of guarantee some property and yet hide actually implementation details. And so if you think about web pages, for example, whenever you access a web page, it speaks a standardized protocol. That's HTTP. That's why when you type in a URL in your browser, you see that those four characters in front of that, HTTP colon, and then something like, you know, www.cnn.com. That's saying speak the HTTP protocol. And what it allows
to... And protocol meaning like a computer program, a small program.
Well, a protocol is actually really a description of how... You know, what is the messages, what is the syntax and semantics of messages that could be sent between between two parties? It doesn't actually talk about, I mean, it, obviously everything is generally implemented in software, but this doesn't actually mean it's a particular, a fixed program. You know, if you look at HTTP, for example, there are hundreds or thousands of different programs that implement the standard. It's just that what they are, it's like saying, you know, what a protocol is like a human language, like English, right? It's saying there's words, there's pronunciation, and between those words and pronunciations, people could communicate with one another.
Okay.
That's generally what a network protocol means. And so where we're going with this notion of abstraction is that, well, if I want to connect the two, if I want to connect two programs together, two computers together, do I need to call up my buddy and say, hey, I want to speak to you in a certain way, you know, go learn my language? Or, you know, is there a, I used English, but lingua franca of the way we can communicate? Can we say that if we each implement this particular way of communicating, then we know we could communicate over the network? And that's effectively what layering did. It said that if we all implement this one standard, this way that we want to we want to take messages and split them up into little packets, and the way we address those packets so that different computers on the internet know where to ultimately send them, then we could basically build this model where we could always connect more and more computers to the network, and they'll still all know how to speak with one another. And what the kind of the magic of that layering is, and I said connect more and more computers, is that the basic information that was sent in each packets back in the 70s and today, much of that is very similar. And so these protocols have actually changed very little. And the reason that was important is it gave us what I sometimes refer to as, people refer to as future-proofing the network or future compatibility, right? Often in software engineering, you talk about backward compatible. How do I know that when I, you know, do a software update, it still works on Windows XP? What a nice layering model will look like is when I build a piece of software today, how do I know that in 10 years from now, it's still going to work? Because when you're talking about building protocols that can be deployed all across the network, it's very hard to update them. Kind of once you release them, the genie's out of the bottle, and you better hope that what you did kind of stands the test of time.
By analogy, is it like I can build the foundation of my house, and then when I want to redo my kitchen, I don't have to redo the foundation. It's like it's built. The complexity is at the surface layer. What's at the?
I'm happy with that analogy. I mean, or put it different, and the layer, and this notion of building on top is a good one, because when you think about layering, what this was really designed for is logically to think of these things as going all the way down to what people call as the link layer, which was how does your phone communicate with a cell phone tower, or how does your laptop speak Wi-Fi? That's so-called the link layer. The network layer is how do those messages being sent off your laptop go all across the internet to, you know, speak to a server over there at owned by Netflix to send you back your favorite movie? And the application layer, which is where most of the action happens, which is how do we build new type of services on top of this network? And if you look at the reason that this thing has been future-proofed is it said we actually don't need that much from the network. In fact, that was one of the kind of key fundamental ideas of the internet, is that you had mostly a dumb network, and you moved all of the smarts and all of the choice to the endpoints, to the computers. And this was very different from what came before. Before that, we had that in the telecom network, all the intelligence was in the core of the network. You know, Ma Bell built these big computers or big machines and made all of this decision about what services are available, when, you know, your endpoint is that, you know, really stupid analog device that you pick up and just, you know, dial the numbers on. And you could look at and say, you know, I remember as a kid watching commercials on television from AT&T saying we're going to get video conferencing any day now. And I don't think that vision was ever realized from my telco provider. But, you know, it certainly became realized over the internet, where we didn't have to wait for the ISPs to deploy video conferencing solutions. You know, Skype came along, earlier things came along, and we could just immediately do this at running on software on the endpoints.
Okay, so let's bring this to Ethereum, which, I mean, Ethereum is not promising to lay new cables for that will be sure. A new internet, but it is promised as kind of a new worldwide web, a new operating system for the web, kind of a rethink of the protocols and the software architecture of how we communicate online.
Yep.
How does Ethereum mesh with this? Does it violate this kind of vision of layering and a dumb network that you've laid out?
Well, none of it really violates this layering model, at least that I described, because all of these things, perhaps one of the limitations of the initial layering model is that almost all the interesting stuff was thrown up into the application layer. Everything we talk about in the world of web today is part of what, from a network perspective, is just part of the application layer. And so what the network layering model was really said to do was focusing on how do we build the network infrastructure. And instead, let's move all of, you know, most of the real interesting stuff into the application layers, into the endhosts.
And the application layer would be Twitter,
the computer.
Facebook, or it would be...
Twitter, Facebook, but your web server that's sitting on your home, and in fact a blockchain miner. A blockchain miner is, and an Ethereum node is just speaking an application level protocol, that is Ethereum's networking protocol over the internet. Mm-hmm. From the internet's perspective, it doesn't matter that's Ethereum or Bitcoin or email or Google's web search. They're all the same. Now, so then the question is, well, isn't this all part of the, it doesn't violate anything, it's just an application layer. One of the things that that happened in the internet architecture is all the interesting stuff moved up into the application layer. And so then we can look back and says, well, did it actually solve some of the fundamental problems? Because what started happening is that in order to make the internet trusted, we started building out services that the whole internet relied on. And some of those include DNS. If you type in any URL, you rely on some infrastructure. This is
DNS is how you find, say, Amazon.com, right? It's a directory.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. It's a directory that maps these human readable names into IP addresses. And IP addresses are those things that the underlying network uses. It's like your post office address. It's those things the underlying network used to figure out how to send your data to its destination, like the servers that Amazon.com is running on. And so in order to use the applications, it turned out that we needed to rely on things like DNS or relying on, and when you log into Amazon.com, the reason you trust that you could buy stuff there and you're not speaking to, you know, some malicious hacker is that your browser comes pre-configured with cryptographic information from some specially trusted parties that are then going to have a relationship with Amazon, and they're going to tell you, oh, by the way, this is actually Amazon who you're speaking with. And those are often called certificate authorities. And so what happened is, while we are still running on top of the network, there were some fundamental things that everybody started relying on to have a secure internet. And so I think that's some of the best criticism that the various services that are looking to decentralize the internet are having, is that should that trust be held in a small set of arms, of hands, and is that trust well placed? Because there are a number of situations where the people entrusted with that information didn't really keep up their end of their bargain, either because of security bugs and perhaps security incompetence, sometimes their own commercial reasons.
So Ethereum, the structure of Ethereum, where applications are running on this blockchain that everyone shares, that is in harmony with this model, this dumb network model that's made the internet so scale so well.
It's kind of an apples to oranges kind of question. From a strict networking layering perspective, it doesn't violate any aspect of it. But if you ask me about, if you aren't so dogmatic about the question and look at, what is the way that Ethereum and Bitcoin and these blockchains are scaling, the basic way they're scaling to date is that effectively everybody knows all bits of information, that's kind of pretty counter to all ways that we scale, that we've scaled services before. Either it's sharding or the very traditional approach of using hierarchies. So the way DNS and many services on the internet and even in nature work, the way they scale, is that you have a hierarchy of who knows what, and the closer you are to the top, the more coarse grain your knowledge is. And so if you ask, who needs to in Ethereum's world or Bitcoin's world, does everybody know, who needs to know about every single transaction? Well, only a small set of involved parties does, even though, there might be some parties out there that have a better view of, let's say, that this transaction happened in North America, and they might know some people in North America. That's kind of how you use hierarchies to scale things.
Let me wrap up by getting to Blockstack, which is a project that you're an advisor to, and it came. Munib Ali, who's one of the co-founders, got his PhD in your computer science department at Princeton. Tell me about this project in relation to what we've been talking about, and why you think it might be a better model to bring some of these decentralized aspects to the web than say Ethereum.
Well, I think it's trying to solve a different problem. And so in a lot of our conversations about, what is Ethereum doing or some other projects doing, is that it particularly has this worldview, or it seems to have this worldview, that basically we want everything to be running on this globally audited system. And so all the reasons that, or a lot of the reasons that we're talking about scalability is, you know, a common number that's given is, you know, Bitcoin today does on average 7 transactions a second, close to that. And at its peak, I think the Visa network does 200,000 transactions a second. And if you look at, you know, the number of requests coming into Facebook or Google, they're going to be probably way higher than that. Now, you can ask the question of, does this mean that, in fact, what we need from Ethereum or the blockchain, do we need the network to do 1 million transactions a second in the network in a way that's like globally audible that everybody can see? And maybe the answer is no. And maybe the answer is instead, you kind of figure out precisely what are the actual security properties you need that have this kind of globally audible view. And what are the things that you could then take, some people in this community call it off-chain. You know, what does this network bootstrap? What does it allow you to do elsewhere that is hard and allow us to now use kind of other technologies that we know how to do? You know, basic crypto, let's say. Once we use something like the blockchain to figure out what each party's cryptographic keys are, do we need to actually do their transactions on the chain? Or could they just sign something, you know, communicate like they normally did using those keys they bootstrapped via the blockchain and public key crypto as we've known to do it for 30 years, which is that if anybody is later seen to be lying, then you could use the fact that they've cryptographically signed and committed to message and the fact that the blockchain tells you that these are their valid keys to point out that they've done something wrong. So really the question in some sense is, you know, what is the level of global transparency you actually need or in fact want? You know, one of the interesting aspects of this is, do we want all of our computation to be happening in a global way? Or can we ask, you know, do we only want certain properties? Or are we trying to solve more concrete problems? So taking back more concretely to Blockstack, you know, one of the things, and I talked earlier about, is DNS and certificate authorities. That one of the problems with today's internet is that everybody relies on what are effectively 13 or so parties who are running the so-called root DNS servers, that if they ever were to, some of them were to go down, that creates availability problems. But if any of them were to basically lie, they could basically do that at will. And the problem
which would be sort of like to send us to, we type in Google, we're relying on one of these services to route us to Google, and they could send us elsewhere. Relying on this. Okay.
Correct. And the same with certificate authorities. When you see that little lockbox, you know, that little lock in your browser bar that says this is actually Google that you're speaking to, you rely on the certificate authority to make that secure. And in fact, people have found out that different certificate authorities were found to be giving actual incorrect information, probably purposefully, in order to satisfy what are often, to satisfy the requirements or the asks of local governments that they're operating in. And so, you know, ideally what you want is the internet that when you think you're speaking to, in order to try to talk to Google, you could A, figure out what, you know, where Google servers are located and somehow establish communication with the real Google, and then have a way that once you speak with them, have a way to be confident that you're actually talking to Google and not somebody else who's trying to listen on the information or in fact even change the results of your search requests. Now, does that mean that we actually need that, you know, Google doesn't provide a service? Do we need to get rid of Google and in fact make everybody's search queries public to the entire internet? I would actually think that most people would not want that and would actually think that's a massive backstepping in terms of privacy. So, you know, decentralization does not necessarily mean, you know, better privacy. It is really much more a function of what problem we're trying to solve. Is this a good problem for the solution? So what I like about Blockstack is that it's figured out what are some of the right things, what are some of the services that are missing today that we could leverage the blockchain to provide and kind of disintermediate these kind of trusted parties like certificate authorities and the DNS root servers that perhaps are playing a larger in life role in the internet than what some of the early architects of the internet would have wanted them to do. So if the early internet wanted to be able to be decentralized, we now have certain entities to provide naming and security that are much more centralized than we thought we probably want. So what Blockstack allows you to do is actually kind of say, these services we don't need to make centralized. We don't need to make trusted. Now, what you want to build on top of this, that's up to you. And I think that's actually much more conceptually in line with this layer of, with this notion of layering, that said it wanted to enable choice at the application layer. If you want to build a decentralized search engine, you could do that. If you want to build Google, you could do that too. And so it really enables choice while kind of allowing you to bootstrapping trust that as a user, I have choice in who I use, and I don't have to trust other parts of the internet that I don't really have a relationship and I probably don't have good reason to trust in order to decide that I want to use Google or I want to use, you know, DuckDuckGo or the latest, you know, greatest decentralized search engine out there. What Ethereum is trying to do is figure out is how do we make as much computation as possible part of the kind of global blockchain. Now, it very well could be that when people build onto applications on top of Ethereum, they might start deciding, well, let's do some of my application in the Ethereum blockchain itself and some of it what they would call off-chain. And, you know, you could get orders of magnitude difference in what you could then do off-chain or on-chain. But fundamentally, I think the whole view of Ethereum sharding and Ethereum scalability is trying to ask the question of how much more support can we put in the chain to allow more and more computation on the chain. And what Blockstack, I think, is trying to instead say is that, again, these aren't, there's not always a, as much as we'd like them, there's not always a crisp demarcation between these two worldviews. But what Blockstack has basically been trying to say is what are the minimal things that we need to do on the chain in order to give us the type of security that we'd want to build a lot of very interesting applications off-chain. So Blockstack's, in some sense, focus is how do we enable secure applications off-chain given the what we can do on the blockchain. And Ethereum is trying to say, how do we put more and more type of computation in our form of smart contracts on the chain itself?
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate your time, and I think we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for the Reason Podcast. Please subscribe at iTunes and drop us a rating and review while you're there. For more on Ethereum and Blockstack and the promise of these decentralized computing platforms, go to reason.com, where I'll post links to our past stories. For Reason, I'm Jim Epstein.